Hi, I'm David Manti, and welcome to a new episode of the Today in Manufacturing podcast. With me this week are Ben Munson and Anna Wells. We each have more than 15 years of experience covering the manufacturing industry. Every week, we take the five most popular stories on our websites and discuss the implications they have on the industry moving forward. Before we get started, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You could also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use. If you want to email the podcast, you can reach any of us at Ben, David, or Anna at IN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. We're also live every Thursday, so you can subscribe to us on YouTube at IN Magazine and get a notification to join us live in the chat. Munson, 2 weeks in a row. How you feeling?
I know, I'm back. And I feel great.
He feels great about it.
I feel great being here. Yep.
Yeah, no, thank you very much for jumping in last week. And Anna, thank you very much for running everything. I thought you guys just crushed it.
Oh, thanks. We did our best, and that's, you know, as good as we can do. But thanks for the kind words.
Yeah, no, I listened to it almost live and just realized, like, it's a tidier conversation without me just, like, without the loud blowhard, you know, just like, it's just like, here's my point. Yes, that is a good point. And not just, well, wait a minute, Jeff, what exactly do you mean?
But guys.
Yeah.
Well, back this week. Now you can do it today.
So. Yeah, no, looking forward to it. Anna, how are you doing this week?
Doing great.
You are doing great?
Mm-hmm.
None of us are doing as well as Jeff. I think he timed it perfectly. You know, he's taking a vacation, and at 1:29, he sent me a photo of the serene lake. You know, he's out on the lake looking at the foliage and the colors. You know, everyone right now, that's how I knew I was getting older, is that my wife just started talking about the colors and the trees so much more often. And I'm like, my goodness, I don't care. It's just fall. That's what's happened every year for our entire lives.
You don't care?
No. I mean, it's like I take it in, I see it, and I'm just like, that's nice. But not enough to be like, hey, Munson, look at those trees.
I wish you would.
Well, next time I go for a walk, I'll let you know. Just be like, you got to go to the southeast corner, yeah. Man. It's just humming back there.
The colors are popping.
All right. Well, before we get started with our first story this week, we have a word from our sponsor, SIGA Technologies is back. This week's episode is brought to you by SIGA Technologies. While it has always been at the forefront, more manufacturers are giving even more attention to how maintenance programs can drive greater efficiency and productivity. Register now to watch Jeff's new interview with Stephen Timms, SIGA CEO, to hear how manufacturers are increasing tool time 2 hours per day per technician. And I think we're actually closing this one out soon. So register now because it's going in the vault soon. Our first most popular story this week. First most popular?
First most, not the
our
first most.
Our fifth least, most popular, like
least most?
Least most popular story this week. UAW justifies wage demands by pointing to CEO pay raises. The United Auto Workers Union has a somewhat singular focus. If the CEOs at Detroit's Big Three made 40% more over the past 4 years, workers should get the same. UAW President Sean Fain often uses that figure to compare it to the 6% pay raises auto workers have received since their last contract in 2019. Negotiations between the UAW and the Big Three opened with a demand for a 40% wage increase over 4 years, along with the return of pensions and cost of living increases, but the UAW has lowered that to 36% wage increases. The automakers say such a pay increase isn't possible to remain competitive, but Fain recently told CBS's Face the Nation, quote, the reason we ask for 40% pay increases is because in the last 4 years alone, the CEO pay went up 40%. They're already millionaires. Our demands are just. We're asking for our fair share in this economy and the fruits of our labor. Part of the problem is the math. GM's Mary Barra said, quote, I don't know where the 40% came from. So here it is. Barra's pay has increased 34% since 2019. Ford CEO Jim Farley is earning 21% more than his predecessor Jim Hackett. And Stellantis CEO Carlos Tavares is making 77% more than the former CEO at Fiat Chrysler, Mike Manley. According to the AP, however, you slice the numbers, the gap between CEO pay and rank and file workers at the three companies, Anna, is gigantic.
It is. That, I think, is very hard to deny.
Yeah, and I think it's like the divide has never been larger.
Yes,
as well.
It's a massive gap, and I'll get to that in a minute. But what I want to say first is what is clearly happening here is Sean Fain and the UAW are trying to build a narrative, right?
Mm-hmm.
This campaign seems like it might be working, at least as it relates to public sentiment. Because I will say this, I have not seen Mary Barra's name in the headlines as much as I have in the last week.
Mm-hmm.
In regards to her pay package, that has been covered pretty widely in recent weeks. And I think you all know how I feel about execs being paid such insane multiples of what the workers make.
Mm-hmm.
But Mary Barra and Jim Farley, they're not the worst of this extreme. Like, the AFL-CIO ranks executive pay every year.
Mm-hmm.
And on their 2022 list, Mary Barra was 87th and Jim Farley was 171st. It's not that I don't appreciate the disparities,
yeah,
but and I do think that their wage far outpaces what I believe their skill is and what they contribute to the organization and their expertise.
Mm-hmm.
That is not to scale, in my opinion. However, this is far from an automotive industry problem. This is an everywhere problem. This,
yeah,
is like a societal wealth distribution problem. I think Fain is pointing this out because it's a cultural rallying cry.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, that's what he needs to get the support from the observing public. Because as the strike continues, the pressure on him is going to get worse and worse and worse, right? Automakers also have some tricks up their sleeves. You've seen them kind of playing their hand a little bit with laying off people, what they call the knock-on effect of the strike.
Mm-hmm.
So they're blaming the UAW for other layoffs that are happening in the industry. Depending on how long the strike goes on, it's going to get harder and harder and harder to be in the UAW's shoes if there's no movement, especially if there's more layoffs. Sean Fain and the UAW, in my opinion, need a villain in this scenario. They need to be bold and kind of painting that picture before they become that villain.
Correct.
Yeah. In the public eye. So I think that's where they're going after these executive comp plans, because they're trying to paint the CEOs themselves as the faces of this corporate greed that's driving the problem. Because there has to be a face,
yeah,
you know, and you know, there has to be someone to blame. This is like a chess game, and it's going to be very easy to quickly lose your position if you're the UAW, unless you're trying to be ahead of that. So I think that's what they're doing here, is just trying to make those people the fall people in this very complex scenario.
Do you think if the strike kind of goes on for an extended period of time, this kind of, I wouldn't call it, maybe it's a wrong word, an attack,
mm-hmm,
on the upper executives, the C-suite, do you think it'll hold up?
I do, because it's a tactic, and I think it's important that Anna puts the cultural context around it, because it is not just something that the UAW workers are experiencing. It is something that everyone is experiencing. So while the automakers can kind of counteract that by trying to make the UAW the villain by laying off all these non-union workers, all of those non-union workers are seeing the same disparity when it comes to the distribution of wealth. And I think it becomes more relatable, the side that UAW is arguing versus the side that the C-suite is arguing. So we've had ongoing coverage of the situation on our site, because obviously it is the biggest story in manufacturing right now. I think collectively, the UAW strike at the big three would have been number one. But it's interesting that our coverage, this story was the most popular. And I think it's not just because Fain needs that villain. I think the relationship between the C-suite and the floor is already adversarial. You know, and that's the easy villain. They've always been the villain, mm-hmm, you know, the C-suite. And now it's that not only does a villain have all the power, but they also have all the money. And Of all the rallying cries, I think that one will hold people together the strongest. I don't know. It's just my opinion. And I think it's not that they just need a villain. I think that's kind of, it's the baked in villain, if you will. I don't know. When you look at what's going on with the UAW and auto workers, Ben, do you think a lot of the story comes back to they're asking for too much? You know, I kind of poked fun at the fact that they were asking for 40% over the next 4 years and then lowered it to 36% over the next 4 years. Are these asks too big? And is a result of that, like, you know, we're just going to remain at the sticking point until there's a little bit more of a concession?
Well, it seems like they're getting closer. And even I think Sean Fain said their demands were a little bit audacious,
mm-hmm.
right? But it's probably a good idea to start a little higher than what you think. And he's got this figure, this 40%, you know, for the executives. And so it's a logical starting point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So Dan, who is watching us live, thank you very much for joining us, Dan. Dan says, UAW leadership must think we are all fools. We know the reduced or eliminated CEO salaries would not add noticeably to the pay of the rank and file. At least some of the knock-on effect is real. And agreed, I think that's not the point, Anna, if the CEOs made zero, that there would be this wealth distribution amongst the rank and file. I think it's the gap, right? Just bridging the gap a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Anna, do you have any expectation of this situation coming to a conclusion, let's say in the near future?
I sure hope it does. You know,
that
it's
means no.
I think of any of the UAW leaders that we've seen in recent years, Sean Fain is the most aggressive. Mm-hmm. And so if there's anyone that could carry this down to an absolute breaking point, I do believe that he has the fortitude to do that, whether that's good for the UAW workers or if that's just an attempt to prove a point that he's going to die on that hill.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, I mean, it could again, like the longer goes on, the more pressure there is on him.
Mm-hmm.
So at some point, there's going to be a lot of encouragement, probably from both sides, for the UAW to start making some concessions there. But we will see what happens. It could be a while.
A couple more points on the disparity, right? It would take an average GM worker 362 years to make what Mary Barra is making every year. At Ford, 281 years. At Stellantis, about 298 years. And we understand that it's not reasonable to expect rank and file to make the same as the CEO. But when you see those sorts of ratios, it's easy to put that on a sign, put it on a stick, and walk in front of a business saying, hey, it's just not fair.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is why you have the power of the union. And like, as we've seen, the power of unions ebbs and flows. So they have power right now. And I mean, you kind of got to get while the getting's good, or at least relatable, you know? I don't know. Do you don't think that, Anna?
No, I mean, this is when their contract was up. This is kind of, yes, this is maybe a timely opportunity, but I think a year ago they had more leverage than they do today, where now you're seeing like some layoffs in the last year come out of automotive. You're also seeing some other businesses cut back a little bit as they try to shore up resources in a little bit of murkiness still with the economy.
Mm-hmm.
I know that things are going a little bit better than expected, but there's still a lot of uncertainty around interest rates and inflation and things like that. So I don't think it's a perfect scenario for them to come in and say, we want 40%.
Yeah.
I don't know if that situation ever exists.
Agreed.
I do hope that they get a good deal out of this. I certainly do. But it might mean some back and forth.
Looking at some of those ratios, if you look at the typical pay gap of S&P 500 companies, it's typically at 186-1. So comparatively, at the automakers, they're still making way more than the average worker. And it's also old sad news. According to the study, of the 350 largest publicly traded U.S. firms, the CEO to worker pay ratio was just 15-1 in 1965. So the average workers remained at that one. And the C-suite's gone from 15 to 186 on average and, you know, up to 362 to one. All right. Our next most popular story. One other fact on that is just, I mean, at a base level, the way we're trending in terms of manufacturing jobs, we're still best case scenario at 2.1 million open jobs in 2030. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's why I think that these workers with the skills also have the power, but I don't know. That's just maybe being too optimistic. All right. Our next most popular story this week, Space Factory denied re-entry to Earth. Beware the logistical challenges of futuristic endeavors. The U.S. Air Force recently denied Varda Space Industries' request for re-entry, which is important because the company is trying to land its space factory in Utah. The capsule was designed to make pharmaceuticals in orbit. The factory includes machines set to work creating components needed for pharmaceuticals, like crystals for a drug used to treat HIV. Varda has been trying to land since September 5th, but the Air Force says it denied the request, quote, due to the overall safety risk and impact analysis. The space factory took off back in June aboard a SpaceX rocket. Varda acknowledged the delay, but reassured that its spacecraft was still healthy across all systems, and the company is working on new ways to get the payload back to Earth. According to the company, it can survive in orbit for up to a year if needed. Now, Ben, I understand that this could be just a simple paperwork issue, but maybe we should have cause for concern over, you know, an experimental space factory that is headed back to Earth with contents unknown.
Right. Yeah. It's loaded up with space crystals.
Crystals.
Yeah.
Yep.
HIV killing space crystals. Yep. And all of a sudden it gets right within landing on Earth and they're just like, whoa. You haven't filed the right forms.
Yeah. And I think in this story, Varda comes off maybe looking a little silly, but mm-hmm. I think this is a really early instance of something that's going to happen a lot more soon, too. It's kind of just the beginning of a really new era of regulation and oversight for the Air Force and FAA. Like, commercial low Earth orbit operations are going to pick up a lot in the coming years, especially if projects from companies like Orbital Reef and Sierra Space and Vast kind of actually come together the way they're talking about it. Mm-hmm. And the TechCrunch report about this, they said that Varda expects to perform reentries on a monthly basis by 2026. And that's kind of a totally new rhythm mm-hmm. for this sort of thing. And even an Air Force spokesperson told them that the holdup with Varda is partially about setting just the correct precedence for increased commercial reentry. So I think that Varda is kind of being made an example in this situation, but this is something that they're going to have to iron out because they're not all going to be relatively small space factories full of crystals. A lot of this is going to be, you know, full-size commercial, you know, like spaceships.
Space stations. I understand that right now policing this is impossible. I think in the future, policing it is going to be next to impossible. You joked earlier this week about, you know, the sky, the space net or whatever. I mean, is that the only solution? Just because I think of how easy, well, not easy, relatively easy it could be to get these payloads into orbit without any sort of oversight. And the implications of that, not only of them going up to low Earth orbit, but also, you know, bringing them back down. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's a scary proposition.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure how they're going to kind of regulate all of this. There's going to be a lot of activity, and it's scary for people on Earth mm-hmm. to think about things coming back into space that maybe aren't... It's all a bit experimental, kind of futuristic. And I don't think anybody wants to get hit by a satellite or any other kind of falling space junk. This is there's going to be a lot going on up there, and it's going to be difficult to kind of wrangle all the moving parts.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't think, Anna, we can't deny the fact that this is the beginning of like 20% of all sci-fi movies. Like anyone familiar with Cloverfield or any of the Alien movies, it's, you know, it always starts with that innocent experiment in some sort of, I mean, for lack of a better term, space factory. And then just things go awry when that payload makes it back to Earth.
Well, I definitely thought that at first too, because I was like, what are these crystals? That sounds fictional. Like, mm-hmm. what are we doing up here? Whose idea was this? So I looked into it a little bit because why does this have to be produced in space? That was my first question, which I'm sure it's a lot of people's first question. Like, why does this have to be? Why can't we just make it here?
Yeah it doesn't necessarily have to be made in space, but it can be made better, right?
It can be made better in space. So like the idea here is that, so they send up this capsule in June, as you said. It's apparently hoping to address this crystal situation in microgravity because it makes for better production up there, apparently. Protein crystals that are made in space are said to, this is according to NASA, form larger and more perfect crystals than those created on Earth. So apparently the crystals need to be large and perfect for fighting HIV. I am not a doctor. I don't know what this is, but anyway, there's been a lot of research that's gone into it. The military has funded some of this stuff. Because what Varda wants to do in the end, it's more than just this idea of like going into space, manufacturing drugs and bringing them back down. What they want to do is work with pharma companies, take drugs that are already in existence and make them better, whether that's going into space and making these crystals in a more efficient way and producing greater quantities quicker so they can get the price down or they can add to the efficacy. That's kind of where their role is in this process. So I understand if that whole process makes you uncomfortable. It sort of does me, because when you look at it in the context of this is a cool opportunity, but pharmaceutical processing plants on Earth are very highly regulated. And if you consider that you can actually walk inside of them as a regulator and view what's happening there, you can run tests, you can do all that stuff. They can be inspected. You can't really do that with a spacecraft. You can't, I mean, you could.
Yeah, like what are the checks and balances? Like, is the FDA inspection where they send something up, grab the samples and bring them back, and then they're inspected before anything's allowed reentry? I don't know. It's interesting.
We don't know. And there's also, I think, some questions around, there's been a lot of testing around this, but still some questions around how do the contents of the vessels survive the reentry? Are they manipulated in some way? Are they changed? Are they functional in the same way as they would as something that you would produce on Earth? Yeah. Again, a lot of research is going into this, so it's not just these companies. Like, it's not like that Titanic ship thing, you know. It's like there's an actual industry of people. There's a lot of money behind it trying to figure this stuff out. So there's experiments happening at the space station now. There's more stuff being done in space, not just Varda. But I do think that, Ben, you raise a good point about how the FAA is trying to make an example out of this company. Because, you know, initially in the report that we ran, it said that overall safety and risk analysis were paramount, you know, to the decision in denying the reentry. But ARS Technica quoted an FAA spokesperson of also saying that Varda Space Industries launched its vehicle into space without a reentry license, and that the FAA denied the Varda reentry license application because the company did not demonstrate compliance with the regulatory requirements. So obviously they're getting their hands slapped here for what they did. And that makes me a little cautious just looking at them as a company, because that seems like a big box to check, you know? And if they're not playing nice with regulatory agencies in an industry where the regulatory agencies have a ton of power and leverage, because this is basically uncharted, it'd be easy for them to say, like they're due with autonomous driving, like, no, we just don't know enough. It seemed like very remiss, like a pretty catastrophic oversight to think that you could, or hubris or whatever, go ahead and you know, ask for forgiveness later.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd think, and since this is such an early industry, you know, actually making crystals in low Earth orbit,
right,
which is bound to explode at some point.
But huge. Yeah.
Right now it's in its infancy, and you'd think they would want to work very closely with regulators and just kind of make sure everything is on the up and up.
I totally agree. And then if you're thinking like this is the contents in a life-saving drug, and public trust is a huge part of like how that operates and whether this succeeds or not. Like, they really need to be serious about what they're doing. Like, if they're cutting corners with paperwork, mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm interested in whatever crystals they're producing.
Yeah, where else are they cutting corners?
Yeah.
Well, and it's interesting too, because at this point, at least what Varda is doing, I think sounds largely automated up mm-hmm. there. And mm-hmm. there's no people involved in this. But if space manufacturing continues to scale and people are involved in it, you raised a good point. Like, how do you just kind of... how do you monitor that? I mean, mm-hmm. is there eventually going to be like a space OSHA?
Yeah.
They just pull up their shuttle and...
Yeah, space OSHA. And I mean, okay, just think about the idea of additive manufacturing, right? We haven't even scratched the surface in terms of the full capabilities of what additive manufacturing will mean for creating new products that are otherwise have been unmanufacturable. So design engineers can't even wrap their brains around how to fully embrace the technology, right? And so now, as we're just trying to learn additive manufacturing, we're supposed to learn how to design for space manufacturing. I mean, and that sounds ridiculous and futuristic, but that's legitimately what's happening in this story, right? Yeah. I mean, it's crazy. Just like, all right, I understand how we're going to make it here, but how do we design to make it in space? And I mean, the regulatory aspect is, I mean, is there like an OSHA arm of the Space Force then? Which sounds ridiculous. I understand that that is a ridiculous question, but it's like a real question and they're going to need to figure it out.
They will.
Yeah. All right. How do you strike at a space factory? How do you walk off the job?
How do you pick it?
Yeah. Just we're taking the escape craft.
Yep.
And we're out of here.
We got the crystals. We're taking them with us.
That's right. You want the crystals back. You pay us.
Yeah. You drive your Fast and Furious car. Into outer space.
The Fast and Furious space car. As long as Luda's behind the wheel, you're fine.
Yeah.
All right. Our next most popular story this week. Officials find debris from F-35 fighter jet that crashed in South Carolina. On Monday, the military uncovered the crash site of a stealth fighter jet that went missing in South Carolina. The debris field was found in Williamsburg County, and even though authorities asked for help finding it, not that now, they kind of insist that you stay away from it. Just like, hey, if anyone could help us find this, we could really use a hand. Now that you found it, stay away from it.
Get my out God. Of here.
Military personnel have been looking for the jet since the pilot parachuted to safely into somebody's backyard in North Charleston at about 2 p.m. on Sunday. In a statement, the Marine Corps said the, quote, mishap is under investigation. It's the third event documented as a Class A mishap over the past 6 weeks. Now, these are real things. I thought that this was just the Marine Corps being a little cagey. But apparently, a Class A mishap is an accident in which damages reach $2.5 million or more, a Department of Defense aircraft is destroyed, or someone dies or is permanently disabled. Well, Anna, this warplane costs about $100 million a piece. So... check two boxes with that one.
Yeah, that's officially a Class A mishap if I've ever seen one.
I'm going to start using that for, like, if I drop a whole lasagna on the kitchen floor. We got a Class A mishap over here.
We had a Class A mishap right before we started filming the podcast. Somebody completely emptied the coffee pot, and we didn't have time before we went live, before the next pot to brew. That's a Class A mishap right there.
Oh, wow, you got one.
Mm-hmm.
You got one on your hook. That's a real Class A mishap.
So, Anna, what are we going to do about this crashed jet in debris field in South Carolina?
Well, this is an interesting story. There's been so much interest in the story, both on our site and in the mainstream media as well. And I think it's pretty clear... to me anyway, that the military knows a lot more about what happened here mm-hmm. than they're revealing at this time. So much of this speculation is really just useless theorizing. That's why it's hard for me to read this story, because it's like, everyone's got a theory. But
oh yeah, the entire story is, these are the four details. Mm-hmm. Let's talk to anyone that might have any idea about what happens.
I know.
Throw it together.
Yeah. There was one, they interviewed this family who was like having a birthday party for their child, and they saw the plane in the air.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow.
Well, and what's funny to me is like, so the pilot, as you said, discharged safely into someone's yard. He was hospitalized He was listed in stable condition at the time of the printing of this article. But then later it was reported that he had been discharged from the hospital and had actually sustained really no injuries or no major injuries. So what that tells me is that he is conscious, right?
Yeah.
So that alone is evidence that there is a lot more information that the military has that we don't, because they've been able to speak with the pilot.
Yeah, he's been debriefed.
Right. So I think, and there has been so many weird reports too. Like initially they were saying that the craft flew for many miles on autopilot.
60 miles.
60 miles. But then they kind of walked that back a little bit. Jeremy Huggins, who's a spokesperson for the Joint Base Charleston, later told NBC News that authorities did not know whether that was the case. We're still investigating. There was a meteorologist in South Carolina who shared audio of the call to the emergency medical services that allegedly this pilot had made, where he described the situation, saying he was unsure of where his plane crashed and that he just lost it in the weather.
Oh, okay.
I know there was some speculation on our site of maybe there was like an oxygen issue, and maybe that would explain this very odd explanation.
Or decision making.
A situational report obtained by the AP from the Marine Corps officials said that the pilot experienced a malfunction and was forced to eject at an altitude of approximately 1,000 feet. You know, as you mentioned, or as the article mentions, David, there was a stand down, they were calling it, where they did 2 days of training to try to discuss aviation safety matters with personnel, best practices, things like that for all of their aviation units. And so hard to know with all those facts combined. I mean, it sounds like it could have been a mix of a mechanical issue and maybe the response as well, because of all this follow-up training that seems to be taking place. But again, without knowing what this pilot has to say, I think we just kind of have to wait until we get more information from the military, which hopefully will come at some point because there is so much public interest in this. I think it's important that they kind of clear a few of these things up.
Well, this was a Marine Corps variant of the F-35, right?
Mm-hmm. So it
had different features, like vertical takeoff and landing.
Yeah.
But then it also has an auto-eject feature, which is not part of the other variants, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, when they're talking malfunction, I mean, I think there's a lot of speculation that this thing just shot the pilot out.
Accidental auto eject.
That was one of the crazy parts or theories that I saw too, is that it could have just been a simple manufacturing defect in the seat that shot the pilot out. I mean, and that would be crazy.
Yeah.
I noticed that as well on the sort of quote forced to eject statement. Another thing, Ben, that I found really crazy is that when we talk about making these new aircraft or even automobiles, or when we're using these advanced materials, is that when something goes bad, it's hard to find them because, you know, they're by design, they're not supposed to be found. Mm-hmm. And so something goes bad with an F-35B variant, and all of a sudden it's like, something went mad somewhere on the East Coast. If anybody sees anything, just call the hotline on the television. You had mentioned that this F-35 variant is more of a VTOL. It's made so it can take off vertically on amphibious assault ships. It would be interesting to see, because of those people that they reached out to speculate, they seem like a few from those seat manufacturers were willing to talk.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. That was interesting to me, just because I feel like as a defense contractor or anyone related to, you know, you're supposed to be rather tight-lipped.
I would think.
One of those people with information about the story that didn't have, that spoke on anonymity.
Well, in the original account, the jet flew 60 miles, right, without the pilot. But they're walking that back a little bit now. I mean, is there a map of where the, you know, where the pilot landed in relation to where the actual debris field was found? But I mean, to go 60 miles, it was only 1,000 feet off the ground.
It was really close.
This person had to have ejected and just thought, wow, you know, like this plane is just really like leaving without me. It just does not care how I'm doing back here. Yeah.
It's a, you know, it's like a person that feels like something's going bad at the car. He's like, I got to bail. And then the car just keeps going straight. Like, I don't think I needed to bail.
Yeah, it's like when you wipe out on your water skis and the boat just keeps going. I'm like, they're not even looking.
They don't even know I'm gone yet.
Yeah, they don't even know where. Yeah.
I think something that is notable is just the amount of money that's potentially at risk if this is a manufacturing defect of any sorts. So Lockheed Martin's F-35 Lightning Joint Strike Fighter is the most advanced fighter jet in the U.S. arsenal. More than 972 of these warplanes were already built, and the company plans to make 3,500 more. The Defense Department is counting on it to serve for decades as its primary fighter, both for the U.S. and allies. At $100 million each, Anna, that is a $350 billion risk.
Maybe it's not a risk at all, David. We don't know.
Okay, we don't know.
We don't know.
I mean, that's true. That's true. It's, you know, I feel like if they had a little bit of fun with this press release from the Marine, where it was just pretty much all redacted. Just, this is kind of, I mean, at least when, well, not at least, when a situation like this happens that's so public, you know, the pilot landed in somebody's backyard and, you know, there was a very public crash. They got to say something, mm-hmm. right? Can't just be like training exercise.
And ejected in 1,000 feet, that sounds kind of intense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, yeah. Not a lot of time to slow down. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so maybe he was a little disoriented. Oxygen, lack of oxygen or not.
Yeah.
All right. Well, our next most popular story. Explosion at world's largest rail yard prompts evacuations. Last Thursday, at around noon, an explosion shook the world's largest rail yard in western Nebraska. The blast happened inside a shipping container on a rail car at Union Pacific's Bailey Yard in North Platte. It's not clear what caused the explosion, but at least nobody was injured. Still, everyone within a one-mile radius of the explosion was evacuated because of, quote, heavy toxic smoke. One of the containers involved was carrying perchloric acid, which is used to make explosives, as well as a variety of food and drug products. Anna, a couple of things with the story. A, it's hard to believe that something with a heavy toxic plume doesn't have longstanding problems to the community, and that something used to make explosives is also in our food.
Yeah, is it just used in pop rocks only? Like, what is it used in?
Yeah, very low dose explosive, face explosives.
Yeah, I would like to know what that's in.
Probably everything.
Corn pops.
Yeah.
All right.
It's in bottled water.
David's going to look it up.
Perchloric
acid foods.
Yeah.
It sounds like pretty nasty stuff.
Yeah, it does. The other thing that I was surprised to take away from this is the fact that the world's largest shipyard is in America. Mm-hmm. I was actually surprised. I just assumed it would be in the East or India or something. You know what I mean? Like, I just surprised to know that.
Yeah.
So it was interesting.
We got one. We got a logistics world's largest.
Yeah, we got this one. Mm-hmm. Give us the blue ribbon. Did you find anything?
I found nothing.
Oh, okay.
Yes, I am on the case.
We will get back
zero.
To you. We will get back to you on that. So it's interesting. One of the first things that came to mind when I saw this is for so long, manufacturing industry projects have gotten a mixed reaction from their communities. There's been like a lot of not in my backyard sentiment towards manufacturing. And I'm wondering if rail is becoming the new not in my backyard hot button, because rail is getting like the worst reputation from all of these like very traumatic and catastrophic events that have happened in the last year, not to mention what happened in East Palestine, Ohio.
Yeah.
With that derailment that basically trashed a neighborhood. And now the impact to that community, the rail company is coming back and saying that they're going to pay residents out for the lost value on their homes.
Yeah.
People have left that community because of that derailment. It was that extreme of the result. So if this is going to continue to happen, there's going to be big liabilities. That was why it was a little bit hard for me to believe the fire chief who said that he didn't expect any lingering issues or contamination concerns related to the explosion and fire, because the acid inside the shipping container largely burned off and any residue was contained at the scene. The fire didn't spread, they said, beyond the container.
But what about the smoke? right?
But yeah, and then it says the air monitoring didn't show toxic levels of chemicals. If you disagree with that blanket assessment, it's very hard to prove, right? So like, I mean, you can't see the chemicals, you know? It's really hard to be the person to come back at that when they make those kind of statements. I'm not accusing anyone of lying. If I were there and it were my community and that stuff was the toxic black heavy smoke was being, discharged into the area, burning for hours, I would have some concerns, I think, about that. Since this report, investigators have deemed this fire as being accidental. I think that's cold comfort to anyone that lives in the area or works in a rail yard. When it's starting to feel like some of these cars transporting chemicals like this could be ticking time bombs. Anytime there's a derailment, anytime we don't even know what happened here. This car was idle. They said it was sitting idle for hours. So to not know what's causing this and the results can be pretty catastrophic. That's scary, I think.
Well, and that's one of the biggest things with the people in Ohio, right? They left because they were being cagey about whether or not there were any real health impacts of the chemicals that were around them. But I mean, at some point they like saw like a film on their homes and cars. Right. And I get it why you want to leave, but how difficult it is to leave your town. And Ben, we've talked a couple of times about these stories where, and it's not just rail accidents, but any accidents that deal with chemicals and how they evacuate whatever area around the explosion. And then like 2 hours later, they're like, nah, you're fine. They're fine. It was windy. You're all right. Go back to your homes. It'll be all right.
Yeah, it seems like this whole thing got wrapped up fairly quickly. Mm-hmm. And they're reassuring residents, but everybody's pretty sensitive to any kind of mishaps with the railroad right now, especially involving a chemical fire. So I don't think anybody wants to hear about it. Like everything's all good 2 days later, because this stuff sounds pretty nasty. Perchloric acid, in the follow up, the story, they said it was an accident. They ruled it was an accident. And there's kind of a funny line where they said, but experts are still trying to figure out why a tanker carrying perchloric acid, which can be used to make explosives, would explode. And it's like, maybe it's the explosives. But this stuff sounds pretty gnarly. It's used in making rocket fuel. And of course, it's used in making many of your favorite foods that you enjoy every day. It sounds like it has very strong reactions if it comes in contact with almost anything, metal or flammable substances like wood or plastic. I've even seen it described as violent reactions.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So it sounds like any type of leak, regardless of the size or scope of this, could cause a fairly big problem pretty quickly.
So you think it's pretty much fine then, right?
Yeah. I mean, keep it.
It's okay if the burned off rocket fuel explosion. Everything is back to normal.
Okay. Yeah, we wrapped it up.
Yeah.
We don't need to know anything else.
Put a fan in the window?
Put a fan in the window.
A fan in the window and, the towels at the bottoms of the doors, and you're all right. Ben, you talk about that that line where they say it's accidental. And I saw that line and I saw it as a really sad sign of the times where they had to come out and be like, we know it's got to be an accident because we saw no signs of it being a criminal act. And so they felt like it feels like all the issues that we've seen in the food manufacturing industry where it really it became sort of one of those talking points for conspiracy theorists to say like, hey, they're attacking our food supply chain. And I saw it as kind of an unfortunate sign of the times that they had to come out and squash these itchy conspiracy theorists by being like, we know it's an accident. We have no idea how it happened, but don't worry. It wasn't sabotage.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm interested to see how it could happen. And I mean, Ben, can you imagine if they come out and they're just like, yeah, no, it was because the explosives exploded. It wasn't a hard investigation. We actually hung out for a couple of days. Just so you guys thought we were working harder on it.
Yeah.
Anna, you talk about the scale of this place. It is a monster. It's almost 2,900 acres, 8 miles wide at one point. And I guess in terms of the scale of how bad it could have been with an explosion in this area, it was fairly contained.
Yeah, it definitely is a big space. And so they said that there's a few residential areas that are near-ish, but it was a very limited area of where people might have been disrupted or concerned about their homes. So, of course, that's good. But, you know, people work here. And also, it's like the air.
Yeah.
For everyone. So we'd have to kind of consider that too.
Well, I mean, that's one thing that a lot of people don't talk about, right? All the area residents that were evacuated and then allowed to come back. I mean, I didn't see any reports, but there had to be a large number of workers in the area as well. And workers are typically the ones that jump in to try and help with these situations. Not necessarily the first thing to think is kind of get out of, you know, run to safety, safer air. Okay, our most popular story this week. Ford changes iconic blue oval. Last week, Ford unveiled the 2024 F-150, and outside of the new bells and whistles, a few people noticed a subtle change to the brand's iconic blue oval. The new logo removed the smaller silver oval on the outside of the badge, and the outer border of the oval and the lettering are also now white instead of chrome. Oddly, Ford didn't mention the oval's redesign at all, despite it being one of the most recognizable logos in the entire automobile industry. Some would argue, like, the world. It's so important that, if you recall, the company actually delayed some vehicles last year when the supply chain disruptions caused it to run low on badges. Ben, you covered the story, but first of all, is there a better car logo? One that's or a more iconic car logo?
Yeah, you know, I used the word iconic in the headline. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if you guys agree, but it felt safe. I didn't feel like I was editorializing.
Right, no, I agree.
You guys agree?
Yeah. I was trying to think of more iconic, and the only ones I could think of, and they weren't more iconic, but they have, like I thought of Chevy, something that really stands out. I also thought of like Jaguar and Tesla as like stronger, bolder logos. And then when it came to like more recognizable, obviously just in terms of volume, like VW, BMW, and Toyota, but not, I think you're right in calling the Ford logo iconic.
Yeah, I felt okay about that too. And I think that this is an interesting case that they're not wanting to call much attention to it. I actually reached out to Ford to see if they would want to talk a little bit more about the redesign process and kind of the thinking about this relatively small changes that they made. And they declined. They don't want to talk about it any further, which is fair, but maybe they just would rather not call a lot of attention to it. It. Like I said, they didn't mention it in the press release for the F-150, which is this massive kind of layout of everything that's new about it.
Yeah. It's fair, but it's odd, right? Like, I mean, typically with any sort of tweak to a logo, particularly an iconic logo, they want to talk about it, right? They want to roll out the designer behind it, the design team and the methodology behind it. I mean, if we remember GM's logo change and how that was like caused mass uproar because all of a sudden the G and the M were lowercase and they were in softer font. And, you know, it was meant to issue in the EV future. People were crazy about that, but they wanted to kind of explain the reasoning behind the logo switch, right? I mean, does that seem odd to you, Anna, that Ford just doesn't want to talk about it?
No, I don't. I don't think it's odd. I think they did this by design. This is my theory. First of all, I've read so many automotive industry press releases about design changes. And as you guys know, the vocabulary and the subtleties are just so droll and tedious to read through. Like, to me, that's not the kind of press a car company can light up, really. I mean, it's just like, I don't know. If they issue a press release and talk about the way removing a border or changing the color on some lettering, like what their reasoning was behind that, I just like the rationale is going to be so generic and boring. Then nobody reads it. Nobody cares about that. Like, if you do it on the sly, though, and you wait for some eagle-eye auto journalist to find it, which those guys are like the biggest geeks ever, and I mean that in the nicest way, but they will find it, then you get a story out of it that's sort of like a more of like a viral version of
an Easter egg.
Yeah, exactly. And not to mention, you know, you mentioned GM. Like, anytime a legacy brand monkeys with their logo, Like, you're going to have all these loyal followers that make a big deal about it. There's going to be naysayers about what you have done. Look at last week's appraisal of the Johnson & Johnson logo changed by our panel.
Yeah.
And they had a very reasonable rationale for changing it. People don't read cursive anymore. They're not learning it. I get that, you know. But you're still going to have all kinds of people out there who want it to stay the same forever. Mm-hmm. And with Ford, if they're just making these subtle changes, I feel like it's better for them not to trumpet that, you know, just do it iteratively enough that you don't get the blowback from it. And I think evidence of that working is just the fact that this article got a ton of views and hardly any comments because it just, there wasn't enough there to really spark any interest. And I think that that was by design, that they kind of just like slipped it out there and they're going to, maybe they tweak it as they go, but not enough to make anybody mad.
You know, they did have a shortage of the ovals last year, like we mentioned. Mm-hmm. And do you think maybe this, with these kind of slight design tweaks, that maybe the badge is slightly easier to manufacture?
It's certainly possible. But again, like, that's the kind of rationale that just is not going to really resonate with an audience of people who are like Ford loyal, you know, that's just, they just want it to be the way it is or whatever.
And well, yeah. And then you see that headline and your imagination kind of runs wild. Like, what did they do to it? It's like, it's a triangle now. And, we're using Comic Sans font. We think it looks really good.
Talking a little bit about its historical context. So the 1928 Model A was the first Ford vehicle to carry the script in oval on the radiator. The only statement that I saw from anyone on the design team was from Anthony Lowe, Ford's chief design officer. He told the Detroit Free Press, quote, "The updated blue oval debuting on the new F-150 is firmly tied to our iconic heritage, but more legible and focused, making the Ford script easier to read from a distance." And
see, he led with iconic heritage.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're right with iconic. And the legibility, I don't know. That just seems like, that seems like an excuse to me because like,
yeah, how many people are out there? Like, well, there was a blue oval on the front of that truck, but I can't quite make out the word.
That was the same. That was the same rationale that Johnson & Johnson gave.
It's
legibility.
Just, I understand that. But like, if you see a blue oval, they could probably lose the fact that it says Ford and they're still going to know it's a blue oval. I guess what else has that? Like a Subaru has like the blue oval with stars. Mm-hmm. So I guess you don't want any confusion there, but I don't know. It's also kind of like a sad sign of the times where like, if the letters connect, people can't read it. Just like, oh no, no. I don't understand this. Is this one letter? Is this all one letter? I don't see any spaces. None. Yeah. Like,
I don't read scribbles.
Yeah. I can't, I just can't do that. But it's the latest. So in this latest change is for vehicles only. It's not the corporate logo. So it is a bit more subtle. But I do like the idea of it being intentional, almost like intentional viral marketing. Mm-hmm. That's kind of a cool idea. Any other notes on Ford's gross departure from its iconic logo to make it more legible?
I hate it.
I think it looks good.
Yeah. No, yeah. I mean, I felt the same too. And I was definitely that reader. Like when you filed this story, Ben, I was like, oh man, what did they do? Like I was picturing like some version of the H&R Green, like square leg logo. I'm like, oh.
And they're going in a totally different direction. Yeah. Like we're going to spell it fraud now.
Well, and the other thing is, when I see stories like this, I also think that there's someone internally that wants to be like, listen, we had an upper manager who wanted to make something his thing, and this was the only change he could really make and get through, you know? And that seems more realistic to me than, you know, they wanted to make it more legible. Just somebody was like, no. We got to change something with the oval. We got to make this more legible. It just, I don't know. It just seemed like something that came from the top down because they needed to put their stamp on the logo or the Ford legacy.
Are we witnessing the end of like cursive logos? Like what else is there that they'll take away from us?
Yeah, oh, I don't know. Like what other cursive logos are there?
And it's actually, like, is the Walt Disney logo kind of in cursive?
Oh yeah, Disney.
No, that's his signature, right?
Yeah.
Just like no one knew who Walt was anymore and they couldn't read it anymore.
There's actually a ton.
Just block font.
Campbell's, Hallmark, Kleenex, Barbie, Kellogg's, Coca-Cola, Fender. Instagram, that's new.
Yeah.
Do the Instagram kids know what that says?
Maybe that's why they just call it IG. Because they can't read it otherwise. They're just like, what is this silly platform? All I see is an I and a G. No. It would be funny to see new interpretations of these fonts in very simple to read block letters.
Mm-hmm.
Like Barbie, all black letters, block letters.
Kleenex, like super intense, just like
why
all
are
caps.
Why are all these logos shouting at me?
I have a cold.
I think Disney would be the best one. Like you changed his signature. That's all it was.
Get it out of there. Yeah.
All right. Are logos, do you guys think that logos that are in cursive are seen as pretentious?
No.
Do you?
I don't know. No, I'm just trying to think, like, do they look too fancy?
No.
Okay. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe we're past though.
Get out of here with that. Okay. You are.
It's just, you know,
overthinking
it's like,
it.
I don't need your hoity toity Coca-Cola. I need a Pepsi. All right. Well, let's move on to in case you missed it. And before we do, we have another word from our sponsor this week, SIGA Technologies. This week's episode is brought to you by SIGA Technologies. While it has always been at the forefront, more manufacturers are giving even more attention to how maintenance programs can drive greater efficiency and productivity. Register now, right now, to watch Jeff's new interview with Stephen Timms, SIGA CEO, to hear how manufacturers are increasing tool time 2 hours per day per technician. And you know, I mean, sometimes you might just be missing Jeff, right? No Jeff this week. So this is how you can get a little piece of Jeff with you this week.
That's true.
All right. I apologize for saying a little piece of Jeff. My in case you missed it this week. If you guys can believe it, I chose another story about a humanoid robot.
Oh, no.
Another humanoid rabbit. But this time.
Not this again.
They're building a whole factory. I'll get into it. So Agility is going to open the world's first humanoid robot factory. First, it was Aptronics Apollo, but now it's Agility's Digit. Agility Robotics this week announced plans to open RoboFab, a robot manufacturing facility in Salem, Oregon. The company plans to make more than 10,000 bipedal Digit robots per year. Digit is designed for logistics, performing bulk material handling in warehouses and distribution centers. The factory will have a 70,000 square foot footprint, and the company plans to walk at least a few hundred digits off the line in the first year. Once the factory is up and running at full capacity, the company is going to need 500 new workers. And what's more, Agility doesn't just plan to make these things, but they're going to employ them in their own facility, using them for moving, loading, and unloading totes in the new factory. This just seems like a continuation of the humanoid robot story. And every time that we've talked about it, right, when we talked about Aptronics Apollo, it was still developmental stages, right? It was still experimental, beta testing. This, we are talking about real brick and mortar facility, really making these robots, trying to turn out 10,000 a year. And it just seems like it's becoming closer to a reality. One thing I will note is that Digit is more aimed or is solely aimed at distribution centers, logistics, whereas Apollo is aimed more at manufacturing applications as well. But we joke about how there's no need for the humanoid robot, and it's just inching closer, seemingly on a week-to-week basis, Anna.
I know. Why? Just make it a robot with no face. Why does it have to have feet?
This one has less of a face, but it's got like a weird club hand that waves at you.
Why? Like, that's the thing. Like, you are like actively making it harder to recruit human workers when you have these in your facility. Like, first of all, it's creepy that they're walking off the production line. Can mm-hmm. we agree on that?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, why roll them off? They can walk.
I don't. So they're just coming out programmed.
They just kind of come out. Yeah. They just trot out right to work.
Just walk over to their desk.
And yeah. Sit down, grab a cup of coffee.
Log on. Yeah. Ready to go. I just, to me, like, I don't know. They're, again, I've said it before, but they're so unsettling. I feel like that there has to be, I mean, humans aren't really built for, there's so many ergonomic problems with how our bodies are laid out and what kind of work we do in a warehouse. Mm-hmm. So I can't imagine that a human type shape and process is like the best one to apply to every circumstance in a warehouse. I feel like, why do you have to make the robot shaped like a human? Why does it need to have arms and a head and a torso? And I mean, I would think that you could make a robot that's a different form factor and maybe it's better at lifting. I don't know. I don't know what the point is of making a humanoid because people don't like them. You know, the people are creeped out by them. And then I also think maybe they're not the best design.
There will be a Digit Run orientation during employee onboarding where you meet Digit,
get to know him.
Yeah. Get a weird little like nub hug.
Yeah. Like maybe like a mentoring type program where you get paired with a robot and then you guys kind of, you're like work buddies and it look becomes out for
like,
each other.
Yeah. Maybe that's why it's people shaped so it can like ride in your car.
Yeah.
It can ride shotgun and then you can go in the carpool lane.
Yep.
Yeah. And it's, you know, I believe that they're humanoid design because they're fitting into, they need to be in the immediate future fit into applications where there is typically a human body, right? So like basically if we're going to have this huge demand for workers, 2.1 million by 2030, like it's easier to put a humanoid robot in an application where you're supposed to have a human than it is to completely redo your entire manufacturing system, you know, where it's completely automated or I don't know. I just think it's in terms of replacing a worker, maybe it's more plug and play.
Maybe, but also couldn't you just make it like narrow in size and you know what I mean? Like the same basic size, but like no creepy
face,
head movements and waving, the nub wave.
It
take
does
that out of there.
It does have. I don't know the proper term, but like the legs don't move like a human, and that is unsettling because you do see this sort of like humanoid top, and then legs that kind of work more like an animal. One part of this that I thought was interesting was that so they have brought a bunch of partners on board. It's Agility's early adopter partner program that kind of have first dibs on Digit with the deliveries that are starting next year. And it's cool because the partners not only help steer the development and the capabilities for real world use cases, but they kind of get special attention. So you're going to get on-site visits from Agility Robotics. You have dedicated engineering resources. So not only do you kind of, I mean, I feel like if you're part of this program and you have a need, like a huge worker shortage, there's a real opportunity to kind of get some sort of white glove treatment, hand-holding to fit Digit to your specific application. One thing that I noted was that Agility Robotics co-founder and CEO Damian Shelton says Digit was built to solve the problems of today's workforce, like injuries, burnout, high turnover, and unfillable labor gaps. According to Shelton, his quote, ultimate vision is to enable humans to be more human. And again, I don't know. I just think that's a little too altruistic. That by having humans interacting more with robotic counterparts are going to make them more human.
Does he mean like less prone to injuries so they can live their lives?
I don't know. Maybe it just, you know, more free time, more family time. I don't think.
Yeah, no one's getting their hours cut.
No. But you can see if there are going to be more than 2 million unfilled jobs by 2030, the tremendous opportunity for manufacturers if they can even fill a fraction of those. I mean, at 10,000 a year, not even going to come close to filling any, you know, even a fraction of those jobs. But there's clearly going to be demand for some type of solution.
No, I agree. I am not anti-automation in any way. I think that the skills gap is driving adoption of more automation. That's been documented. It's according to McKinsey, like close to reaching a tipping point in manufacturing. And that has accelerated since the pandemic.
Yeah.
So I do think that we are going to see more automation type solutions and there is definitely a need for it. However, I just personally don't love the humanoids.
Yeah. Understandable. But it was, you know, every time there's a story like, and we continue to doubt it, it seems like in 2 weeks, it's just like another 2 weeks. It's like, oh man, they're like, legitimately building a whole factory like, dedicated to making them.
Still doing it.
Yeah. It's, I mean, it's one thing when it's, you know, 12 guys at a startup tinkering, you know, like they've got that NASA pedigree and they're trying to figure out how to make it work. But this is legitimate scaling to 10,000 within 2 years. Mm-hmm. All right. Anna, what's your In Case You Missed It this week?
I picked a very different story.
Okay. Okay.
What do you got? It's about a recall that Kraft Heinz issued about American cheese slices over a choking hazard. Kraft Heinz said this week that it was recalling more than 83,000 cases of individually wrapped Kraft singles, American processed cheese slices. Perhaps you've heard of it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because part of the wrapper could stick to the slice and become a choking hazard. The company, which is based in Chicago and Pittsburgh, said one of its wrapping machines developed a temporary issue that makes it possible for a thin strip of film to remain on the slice even after it's been removed from the wrapper. The machine has since been fixed. I chose this story because Kraft Heinz said it initiated the voluntary recall after it received several consumer complaints. And in 6 cases, people said the issue caused gagging or choking. And that was in a lot of the headlines.
Yeah.
Kraft singles could cause gagging. And I was like, well, of course. Of course, eating Kraft singles will cause gagging.
Oh, cheese product snob here.
Yeah. Well, okay. So fun fact about processed cheese. It is good per the dates for about 5 or 6 months, but they say that that's really just the guideline. You can eat it as long as it looks fine and not getting like dried out or gross, because it's got a special ingredient in it that inhibits mold growth. And that was why it was designed that way, in order to be a, you know, shelf stable, I guess.
Yeah. So like cheese end product. Of days, you get the canned ravioli and you can still hit a Kraft single with, you know, relative safety.
You just crack your can of Hormel chili, you toss that on the top.
Yeah. Serve it on a single.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And even once you peel off the plastic, you're supposed to be able to still eat that slice of cheese for a week, which I thought was like the most.
Even after it's unwrapped?
Yeah, that was the most alarming.
Like left out?
They say put it in your fridge, but yeah, once the wrapper's off, it's just.
Who refrigerates an exposed single?
Who does?
I don't know.
I don't know.
Also, if they have such longevity, do we reach a moment in the future where the Kraft single is currency? This will cost you 4 singles.
It's like.
If you want to trade for my chickens.
The cheese standard.
To be fair, though, you could refrigerate it. You could probably just stick it to the side of your refrigerator. You don't have to like set it down.
Oh, true.
It's like, they're pretty, pretty grippy.
Yeah. Like logistically, it's not going to take up any shelf space.
Right.
That's true. Yeah. So the reason I picked this story in all seriousness was just because QC in like a consumer packaged goods application like this, I think is tough because really it's a lot of random sampling.
Yeah. the speed at which the products are being produced.
Exactly. Yeah. So, things can get missed even at a big manufacturer like Kraft, who, you know, does this every day and they have really regimented procedures and strong SOPs. Things can get missed or a machine glitch can happen. And that, we just ran a story about potentially underprocessed cans of Spam that were out in the market.
That one was scary.
That was scary. That's,
no one wants bad Spam out there.
No.
Like with botulism? No, that wasn't botulism one, was it?
They said that, no, it wasn't, but they said that it was possible that it was not fully sterilized in the can.
Yeah.
Received any complaints of like nobody, I don't think, got sick. They don't think it's still out in the market, but they were just like, just a quick heads up, this happened.
Yeah.
But my point is like, so even big companies run into quality problems like that. And you should always, from a consumer standpoint, you should always report the stuff that happens to you if weird stuff happens with food, because maybe it's something that you can easily brush off because you're healthy or nothing happens. But like, it could be a big problem for somebody else. And at a high volume, it's the only way sometimes they know that this stuff has happened is because it reaches market and somebody tells them. So again, just a good reminder that even the big guys, sometimes they get it wrong. And, it's not the best scenario that we have to be the ones to point it out as consumers, but that is the reality, right?
Well, and this is a product that kind of is one of the first products, at least in my kids' lives, where they were actually able to open it and consume it themselves. So a lot of times, and I've seen it with other kids in the family or neighbors where like, a Kraft Singles just a snack, you mm-hmm. know, and because kids can open it and you would be none the wiser.
Yeah.
It was, Ben, I was kind of shocked at this story and how it was a single machine and they caught it, but it was still 83,000 cases of singles that were affected, just showing the speed of what's going on in terms mm-hmm. of this manufacturing process.
Yeah. That thing is cranking out the singles mm-hmm. and,
sheets of them.
Yeah. And having plastic residue on it.
Yeah.
Maybe there's some plastic in it. I don't know, but you don't want that on there because, at least in my house, Kraft Singles are top tier for grilled cheese.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
When my daughter was born, we used to try and make grilled cheese with like cheddar, mm-hmm. you know, cheddar slices that we bought, and then we're finally like, forget it, let's just switch to these. And not kidding, she was like, this is really good. This is probably the best grilled cheese you've ever made. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know why we were even trying anything different. We should have just stuck with the Kraft Singles. But I think I made a grilled cheese last night and I was like, I need to double check because this might have plastic on there. And you could just imagine how much worse it might get if you heat it up.
Oh, well, was what I was thinking about is if you made it and it, say you made a grilled cheese with this, with that plastic still on it, you would melt it, and if you consumed it fast enough, you'd probably never be any the wiser. Mm-hmm. Just be like, yeah, it's kind of a funky grilled cheese. You'd probably blame it on bad bread before you would like a rogue single.
Yeah, it can't be the cheese.
And I was glad that you brought this particular story up and not the spam one.
Yeah, sorry for just like sneaking that in there. But
no, it was, you know, there's a special place in my heart for spam. It's very, it's very specific for breakfast from two individuals in my life. When they make breakfast, spam's all right because they do it great.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's fried and it's delicious.
I don't think I've ever had it.
I can't,
to be honest.
I mean, if I had to bet one person in this world that's never had spam, you would probably be the top of that list.
Well, you got that right.
Just like it's either Anna or a newborn infant. Ben, what's your, in case you missed it this week?
Mine is Motif conducts human trials for brain implant to treat depression.
Wow.
Motif Neurotech has developed a brain implant for treating depression. It's about the size of a pea, probably kind of a large pea, and it can apparently safely stimulate the brain without actually coming into contact with the brain.
Oh,
So
how is it a brain implant that it doesn't even touch the brain though?
Well, it's still, you know, stimulating the brain. So I guess it's, you know, they're interacting, but just not that directly. It's basically a miniature brain pacemaker designed to restore healthy circuit activity.
Wow.
And treat, you know, probably a variety of mental health issues. But the company said it can be inserted during a 20-minute outpatient procedure. And that really caught my attention. Like if that's the case, I just want my surgeon or doctor to just, you know, just lie to me. Just make me believe that it's going to take longer because I don't want brain surgery that only takes 20 minutes. Like I don't want to be able to do it on my lunch break.
Yeah.
Well, it's like a restaurant, right? It's all about churn.
Yeah. Like if I'm getting brain surgery, I'm probably taking the whole day off.
You could order a pizza, get the brain surgery, and then your pizza's still not there.
Yeah.
I would say, if you took off for brain surgery, if there was ever an expectation where it's like, well, I mean, he'll be here for the afternoon.
Yeah.
Yeah. you don't need the whole day for that.
Did it say where the implant goes? Where do they put it in your brain? Like, is it...
Are you going to know if he tells you?
No, well, I mean, like, is it in the back? Well, just because I think for it to be a 20-minute procedure, I mean, they can't be going through the skull, right? Because they would have to drill a hole. And I feel like to plunge a hole in your skull, it should take at least more than 20 minutes.
Yeah, I don't think that's minimally invasive.
Yeah.
If they drill a hole in your skull.
I don't know. I continue to be amazed by this type of technology as it comes out. Because treating depression, first of all, I mean, I don't know what the numbers are in terms of how many people have a depression disorder, but I know that just in my life, it's a lot of people. So it's stands to make a really big impact. And again, just scratching the surface in terms of what else this could possibly do in terms of stimulating the brain and maybe helping with other disorders.
Mm-hmm.
Anna, your thoughts on a brain surgery in 20 minutes or less and you know, how brain implants could help millions of people.
I mean, it is like, it's hard to imagine 20 minutes, but at the same time, when you think about right now, the current treatment for major depression is typically pharmaceuticals, and you can get a prescription pretty quick without them really knowing if that is the one that's going to work or not. And, you know, as you said, like, you know, depression is so common. It's such a terrible condition to live with for a lot of people. And you think about how much trial and error there is with pharmaceuticals, dosage wise, you know, specific formula wise, that whether it works or not for people, sometimes it makes things worse.
Yeah.
Before they figure out that they need to be switched onto something else. And it's just like, it's so much maintenance over time to try to be treating that effectively and correctly. So, interested to see where this goes. I mean, if this is a workable solution for people and they can avoid that, that's pretty amazing. I mean, especially for how non-invasive they say that it is.
Oh, so is it more like a cochlear implant where it kind of sits on top of the skull? Just trying to look at some of the stuff. Like, so it looks like it kind of...
Yeah, kind of hovers.
Yeah, hovers on top of the brain. But is that under the skull? Or is that... Is it kind of like... Just like stick it to the top of your head and they're like, you should be fine now.
You just got like punch a little hole through the skull.
Yeah. Just a little implant tack for your brain.
I don't know. It says it's millimeter sized.
Yeah.
So
yeah, they said it doesn't have a battery. It's wireless. You know, I'm not exactly sure how it draws power or, you know, how it connects to anything. But it certainly is small. I mean, they nailed that part of it.
Yeah. Well, it's an incredible development. And one thing that's kind of exciting is in our life, you know, the previous generation was able to see the Industrial Revolution and how that changed everything in our nation. And I feel like our generation is seeing the technological revolution, and the things that are coming out every day continue to amaze me. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you can... think about treating depression with a simple electrical implant, and that is installed in 20 minutes. Installed is incredible. It's simply incredible. All right. Well, let's do our final thoughts before we get out of here this week. Anna, what's your final thought?
I just wanted to say that I got a lot of great input from the audience on the Toy Story. I'd asked people to weigh in on what their favorite toys were from the list.
Yeah.
And David, I want to before we move on from this, I want you to weigh in on this as well, because you didn't get to last week.
Yeah.
I got a note from Marina, who said that Connect Four and Slime were her top ones from the list. And she agreed that baseball cards are not a toy. Mm-hmm. We need to write them a letter, I think.
I think they throw a couple of rogues in there just to like get people talking.
Maybe.
Just
maybe.
Like, you know what? I mean, like to your point last week, Ben, how they like sand is in there. Mm-hmm. Where it's just like, you know, let's throw something in there where people are just like, I don't understand how a cardboard box is in the Toy Hall of Fame.
Yeah, a stick was on there, right?
Stick. Yes. Yeah.
Stick.
Just stick.
Both Pete and Brian said Nerf and the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. There was another vote for Connect Four. So yeah, a lot of people kind of on the same page. Didn't get any votes for Ken. Unless that's coming from you, David.
No. Like the closest vote I would give to Ken is that I had an MC Hammer doll growing up that was kind of like Ken adjacent, and I would definitely vote for that MC Hammer doll because it came with like the Prey Ka-single, and that just really empowered me as a kid that I had both music and this cool doll with like just really awesome like purple fly suit. Mm-hmm. But no, Ken's not going to get a vote for me.
No.
When I was watching it, when I was watching the episode, I immediately went to the Strong National Museum of Play so that way I could vote, because I think like voting ended like a day or two ago.
Yeah, it was this week.
Yes, I had to vote for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yeah.
Because those... I mean, there are a lot of jokes out there, right? Because they made a Ninja Turtle action figure for every possible thing in the world. Like there was just a series that had Hawaiian shirts. There was the series that were in different sporting gear. There were so many, every villain, there were so many villains that at some point their creative team must have been like, find anything you can, put eyes on it, make it look nefarious, make a toy.
Put it in a box.
Yeah,
they'll buy it.
And you know what? We did buy it. Mm-hmm. We bought it like our... Allowances always went to getting a new turtle. Our every holiday, stocking stuffed with a new turtle. So we had so many of them. And when I saw the photo come out, I was just like, nothing stands a chance. Like, it is hands down Ninja Turtles. And I could see it slipping through where they don't, you know, maybe they're not like a first ballot induction, but they deserve to be in the hall.
Yeah, I do love them. And it was funny because over the weekend, we were over at my parents' house and my dad got this box of toys out of the garage, and my parents still have this entire bin, like neatly organized bin of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles toys.
Oh, yes.
Of ours from when we were kids. And my son, like, loved them.
We
just spent like an hour in that bin, and I was like telling him about Krang and stuff. Like the weirdest thing.
It is that has been one sticking point where we my wife and I typically see eye to eye on everything in terms of educational value or no value, and the turtles is sort of the crossroads where I'm like, this is great, it shows teamwork and family values in terms of like working together with your brothers, and all these good things. And she's just like, it's violent. No, turn it off. I'm like, just wait for mom to take a nap.
That's and then we'll watch ninja skills. Yeah. That's not violence.
But I love, I love like playing turtles with the kids and then trying to figure out how to say Michelangelo.
Yeah. How could it be violent? Leonardo has two swords and nobody ever gets cut.
No one's ever cut.
Yeah.
At worst. I mean, at worst, what, like someone gets hit with a nunchuck or maybe takes the staff, but only like kind of a jab with the staff.
Yeah, or what's the sai that's not even sharp, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, no, yeah, it's a sai, but the sai is only used to catch other weapons. Yeah. Never stab, never slice, you know? Mm-hmm. But the other one is, I mean, obviously Nerf or nothing, because Nerf like revolutionized being able to play. I mean, imagine like the generation or maybe generation of kids that grew up without a Nerf football. Mm-hmm. Just because, I mean, I see my kids learn how to catch and they're catching more with their face than they are their hands.
Yeah.
And I could just see my grandpa throwing the football at my dad. And eventually my dad takes the third one to the nose and he's like, you know what? Maybe not football for me. All right.
I think when I bought my first house and we were looking through it, I was like, which door will work for the Nerf hoop?
Yeah.
Because it's like, it can't be too close to the ceiling. Yeah.
You found one?
Yep, found one.
The Nerf Vortex alone deserves its own spot in the hall. But anyway, no, I was very disappointed in terms of, it was actually, there were a lot of great stories last week and I was disappointed that I had to be on the road, but this one in particular, you know, it's just like, hey, we're going to talk toys.
Yeah.
I'll do that all day. Like, Jeff mentioned that the Choose Your Own Adventure books were a personal favorite when he was growing up. For me, it was a very specific Indiana Jones Choose Your Own Adventure book. And I was blown away as a kid. I'm like, I can read this 100 times. It's always different.
It's so fun.
Yeah. Did they say when they're going to announce the winners at all?
They did, but I don't remember. It's sometime in October, I think.
Okay. We got to wait.
Three winners, right?
Yeah. Only three are going to make it. And I just don't feel confident that the Turtles are going to make it. Like up against Connect Four and Battleship.
Is this like Sports Hall of Fame though? Like if they don't make it in here, they can get in like a second ballot type of thing?
I'm not exactly sure.
Or it's like Cabbage Patch Kids. It's now or never.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, there might be a lot of people out there with negative thoughts about the Cabbage Patch Kids, and they're just like, I was in those stores, man. I cannot vote for this because of what it did to the nation.
People were trampled.
My final thought this week is Jeff, hope you're enjoying the rest and relaxation and fishing where, you know, you actually get to fish on your own and you're not just baiting hooks and taking fish off. The other is that... understanding the slow crush of age is maybe speeding up a little bit for me because I suffered not one, but two sleeping related injuries this week.
It's how you get injured after you turn 40.
It was just, so I slept wrong and somehow hurt my left shoulder because like, I understand if I hurt my right shoulder, like playing softball or something, I'm just like, oh, if you use it, it hurts now. But I woke up and I'm like, what? Why does that hurt? And so I hurt my left shoulder sleeping. As a result of that, I slept differently
and I hurt my hip.
Yeah, my body's always doing that to me. It's like, I got 8 hours of sleep. We should be good, right? And they'll be like, nope, wrong. You did it wrong. You slept wrong. And yeah. Now you're going to hurt all day.
Yeah, and not only did you sleep wrong, everything hurts. And somehow you're still tired because your body was trying to deal with the throbbing pain while you were deep in sleep. And I was stretching out yesterday at softball, and everyone's just like, that's odd. Why are you doing that? I'm like, because I hurt myself sleeping now. And luckily it's an older team. So everyone's just like, welcome, you know, just like, oh, you only hurt yourself twice sleeping.
Yeah, one of us.
Ben, what's your final thought this week?
My final thought is cool pen. I don't mean to brag, but I own a lot of pens, but I got a new pen this week, and it might be the coolest one I have. Oh. It's from this company called Crush Metric.
Okay.
And
it's got a box?
Yeah, it came in its own box.
It's got a box with like a QR code?
Yeah. Like, I don't know if you could see this, but when you...
No! What is happening?
What is that even called?
I don't know. It's the Crush Metric.
It's...
And then when you put when you retract it, it goes back to
normal. That's solid.
So does it like leave an imprint on your hand when you, I mean, does it hurt to use?
No.
Well,
no,
I believe you can feel it, Anna. Yeah. It's a pen. You can just pass it to somebody. No. So
you just push the thing down on the, yeah.
Oh, push this down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a comfortable pen.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an awesome pen, and it writes well. I'm like, this is great.
Oh, it's a good writer. It's not just a novelty pen.
Right. Yeah, I was worried. I was like, I'm gonna buy it for the novelty either way. But it was like, I'll actually write with this.
Yeah, we got to do a
story. I might start using my checkbook again.
You got to do a story on the design and manufacture of this. That feels cool when it like transitions in your hand.
This company, they make the pens, and then they also make a chair, basically. It's like a stool to sit on, and it like crushes down when you sit on it.
I don't care for that. I don't care for a seat that seems like it's crumbling beneath me, because I do that with enough traditional seats already. No, that's cool. The only thing is that like when I see this mechanism, it makes me think of the four color pens.
Oh yeah.
And those just hold a special place in my heart because they're awesome and remain awesome. And then you try to like jam them all together to have them write with multiple colors.
I mean, they're in the Pen Hall of Fame, like first ballot.
I mean, if that's not a thing, I mean, you got to do it.
Yeah.
And I mean, see, we got to do a story about the design and manufacture of how they make this Crush pen, and then we can expense them.
Yeah.
Everyone gets one.
Everybody gets one.
Well, I guess when I saw a cool pen in the notes, I didn't ever think I would agree with you. Just like, all right, Ben's going to share about a pen. How did you find out about it? Were you like a victim of some viral marketing?
Instagram or IG.
Oh, okay.
If you're not comfortable with reading the cursive logo. But yeah, it was there and I showed it to my wife. I'm like, let's get these. She was like, yes. And we got them. And I was like, the day I got it, I'm like, I can't wait to bring this to the office and show it off. I was like walking around. Yeah, look at my cool pen.
You're that guy.
This is really cool.
Yeah. It's truly a cool pen. It's I've worked with the people that buy the crazy expensive pens, the like limited edition hundreds of dollars pens, and it's just like, I'm sorry, we don't relate. Relate to me.
We can't be friends.
All right. Well, before we get out of here, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You can also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use. If you want to email the podcast, you can reach any of us at Ben, David, or Anna at IN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. You can also subscribe to our daily newsletters. Make sure you get it delivered to your inbox first. And subscribe to us on YouTube at IN Magazine. And when you're there, give us a thumbs up so you can help us with whatever the Google algorithm is that helps more people see this in their feed. I don't know. I keep reading about it and I seem to get further and further away from how I could help us out on YouTube from an SEO perspective. Please share it on your iCursive grams. All right. Well, for Ben Munson, Jeff Rangi, who's on vacation, so don't feel too bad, and Anna Wells, I'm David Manti. This is the Today Manufacturing Podcast, and we'll see you next week.